Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, drought, stories of suffering. As the drought deepens in the Horn of Africa, we hear a first-hand account from a humanitarian worker who has just returned from the camps in Kenya, where thousands of Somali refugees are arriving each week. Northern Ireland analysing the riots. We speak to the auxiliary bishop from the diocese which covers Belfast about the background to the rioting between nationalists and loyalists in recent days. And unwanted daughters. We find out why millions of baby girls are going missing in India due to the growing practice of aborting female fetuses because of the strong traditional preference for a boy. The World Food Programme is appealing for urgent funding to help feed refugees flocking to camps in Kenya and Ethiopia in the drought-stricken Horn of Africa area. It says the drought afflicting the region has left millions at the mercy of hunger and predicts that the number of those who need food aid could rise from the current 6 million to 10 million in the coming months. One person who has seen with his own eyes the suffering caused by this drought crisis is David Orr, a spokesperson for the WFP. He's just returned from his latest visit to the refugee camps at Dadaab in eastern Kenya, where more than 1,000 Somalis are arriving each day after trekking for days or sometimes weeks from their homeland. It's the Horn of Africa's worst drought in 60 years. And I asked Orr how badly the people are suffering.
Well, they're suffering considerably. These are people who've been living in very abject circumstances, many of them in Somalia itself. Obviously, they're suffering from the civil conflict raging there, also from the drought in the Horn of Africa, which really has taken a great toll on the pastoralists, communities and the farmers in Somalia. Many of them have lost all their cattle, their crops have failed, so they set out to seek assistance in the refugee camps in northeast Kenya, also in Ethiopia. And they are walking for days, in some cases for many weeks, to reach refuge in the camp. They have very little food on their journey. I met some families walking, half a village, in fact, who had set out to walk to Dadaab in northeast Kenya. And in addition to having very little food on their journey, to having small children with them who were quite sick, they had been attacked by bandits and robbed of most of their possessions. So really, they were in a pretty bad state by the time they got to Dadaab.
And presumably there's some people, particularly, shall we say, the children or the sick, who don't make it.
We hear many stories from families who arrive in Dadaab who have lost children along the way. I met one man who had buried his wife before he set out from Somalia. Along the way, he buried one of his children. And I asked him what had they died of, and he said he didn't really know, but he suspected hunger. And we do find that even after arriving in the refugee camps, children continue to die. There's a very high rate of malnutrition. That having been said, we can help them tremendously by, particularly the children, by feeding them supplementary and very nutritious, special, ready-to-eat foods, which can revive them enormously in the days after their arrival. But it's a pretty sad spectacle. As I say, there are high rates of malnutrition, and these are people who have greatly suffered.
And are these people continuing to arrive there?
For the past few weeks, they've been arriving at a rate of about 1,000 up to 1,300 people per day. They arrive at the camps. There are, in fact, three refugee camps at Dadaab. Reception centres have been set up at these camps, and the people on arrival queue up. They get wristbanded. They receive a yellow bracelet, which identifies them as refugees. And once they have got this, then they can get the relief rations they so desperately need from the World Food Programme, also non-food items such as blankets and pots and pans and so on, which will help them to establish themselves. There's a huge backlog of people waiting to be officially registered, but these foodstuffs and these non-food items help them to establish themselves while they're waiting for that.
Is it true that the aid organisations are overstretched? That's what I've been hearing.
But there's absolutely no doubt that the whole humanitarian community in Dadaab is overstretched. The systems are really facing tremendous pressure with these huge volumes of refugees turning up every day. My experience was that we are managing to cope. We are ensuring that all those newly received refugees are getting a two-week food ration to tide them over while they're waiting for official registration. That isn't to say that they are wonderful, but Dadaab camps have been full for many years now, so really there's not much room for them, and they camp in these very makeshift settlements on the outskirts, many of them just in thorn twig huts with a few cloths or blankets draped over them. It's very dusty, it's very unpleasant, and the water and sanitation facilities, as you can imagine, for a population, a total population of about 380,000, they leave something to be desired. But I think a lot of the people, and the refugees will tell you this themselves, that they've escaped such awful circumstances in Somalia that they are very glad to find themselves in Dadaab. They're away from fighting and conflict, and they have some assistance, and particularly the children who arrive malnourished, they can get these supplementary foods that bring them round and sustain them. So by comparison with what they have left, Dadaab is an improvement.
I was reading, in fact, some of the stories of these refugees and what they had to endure also on this very arduous journey. I mean, there was a case of a new mother who had been walking for 22 days drinking only water. Are these common stories there?
Well, most of the people I talk to seem to set out with a little maize or whatever they have been able to amass before embarking on their journey. But certainly they are traveling pretty light because they can't carry huge numbers of things, and they have very young children with them often, and they're traveling barefoot, and it's really pretty sad to see them. We were there recently and we just were driving along the road and we saw this huge line of villagers making their way towards the camps, and it's amazing the sort of fortitude with which they progress. Once they get there, they just sort of sink in front of these reception centres onto the ground, and they hardly have any strength to continue. But once they do get their food and their non-food items, I think they rally somewhat, and they set off and they find a place to settle down, and there is a lot of support from within the Somali community itself. People who have nowhere to stay, these refugees often end up camping with other people and getting some support for them. So they are a very sort of welcoming community and help each other out.
Looking at the wider picture, the WFP says that this drought affecting the Horn of Africa region has left millions at the mercy of hunger. How serious is this situation? I mean, and what has been the response from the West?
Well, the situation is extremely serious in that we've had two failed rains at the end of last year and more recently. In some cases in Somalia, people will tell you that the last 2 or 3 years have been failures in terms of the rains which nourish their crops and so on. The pastoralists have herds of camels and goats and cattle which are dying or have died. So it is an extremely serious situation. We estimate at the moment that we're feeding about 6 million people in the Horn of Africa. That could go up to 10 million people in coming months. So it is a dire situation.
You said it could rise to 10 million people. That's a huge number. Is the WFP confident that it can rise to that challenge?
Well, it largely depends on the generosity of donors around the world. We estimate that we have a total shortfall for this operation in the Horn of Africa until the end of the year of about $190 million. That's $190 million, which is a substantial sum. So, as I say, we are very much dependent on the goodwill of the donors, and hopefully with enough support, we will be able to meet the challenge. But it's obviously a very serious situation, and we take nothing for granted.
Is the drought, in fact, deepening?
Well, this is, I say, the drought is the product of a series of years of poor rains. This year has, in many areas of the region, been the driest year for 60 years. The next rains aren't expected until October. So in the short term, at least, I think we can assume fairly confidently that this situation will continue to deteriorate. A lot depends, of course, on the conflict in Somalia, which is driving many of the refugees towards Kenya and Ethiopia. But as I say, it's not confined just to the Somali refugees who are fleeing their country. It's a regional problem. There are millions of people right across northern Kenya, southern Ethiopia, and Somalia itself who are suffering as a result of this drought. It's a very extensive problem.
And is it almost inevitable to predict that, you know, a considerable number of people are going to die as a result of it?
Well, we've already seen deaths and a lot of cattle lost, crop failure. I think this is the inevitable fallout of this situation, which is the product of a combination of factors, really. In the case of Somalia, obviously, there's the civil war, which has been dragging on there. Then we have the drought itself, which is, I think everyone is agreed, is closely related to climate change. A few years ago, these droughts were much more intermittent, and now they seem to be happening with frightening regularity. And also very high fuel and food prices. We hear of the price of maize, for example, in Kenya rising 160%, the price of sorghum in Somalia having gone up 240%. So these are the sort of things that are really compounding the problem of the drought.
I was speaking to David Orr from the World Food Programme. Leaders from Northern Ireland's Catholic and Protestant churches have appealed to their communities for calm after two nights of rioting in Belfast between nationalists and loyalists. The riots came as thousands of pro-British loyalists held their annual 12th of July Orange Order parades throughout the province. The parades commemorate Prince William of Orange's victory in the Battle of the Boyne in 1690 over the Catholic King James II. The period leading up to the Orange parades this year has been one of the most violent between loyalists and nationalists since the signing of the Good Friday Peace Agreement in 1998. We spoke to Bishop Donal Míchion, Auxiliary Bishop of the Diocese of Down and Connor, who talks about the background to this rioting.
Well, the days and weeks around the 12th of July are always times of tension in Northern Ireland because it's the 12th of July is the day when the Orange Order marches, and the Orange Order would have been founded at the end of the 18th century to try and keep Irishness and Catholicism out of the public sphere in Ireland. So any time when they march, about 250,000 will attend their marches today, is obviously a time that there's a time of tension. However, tension can be lived with. But there are those who are happy to exploit tension for their own purposes. And I think that's what's been happening over this past couple of weeks. Sporadic outbursts here and there. A, by young males who on a warm summer's evening, perhaps with drink, think there's nothing better than having a fight of some sort. You get that in many parts of our world where young males will be involved in recreational rioting. But then there's also those who are very unhappy. A very small minority. Must con- Fein, who are very unhappy with the current peace process and believe that Sinn Fein have betrayed the fight for Irish freedom. So they will use the tensions of occasions like the 12th of July in order to try and provoke conflict, try and provoke disorder, in order to say, look, Northern Ireland is not working, peace process is a waste of time. So there are A, those who enjoy rioting, and B, those who are happy to exploit young males for their own political purposes in order to bring down the current Northern Ireland government. And because of that, Bishop Noel Traynor, Bishop Hiran Down and Connor, issued a very clear and strong statement at the weekend, pointing out that for every difficulty, for every area where diversity causes problems, dialogue can always find a way forward. That's the only way of the gospel, and we have to be fully committed to ensuring that we recognise diversity, that we're actually able to celebrate diversity, and remain convinced that with the grace of God, we actually can find solutions to all our problems, and that violence, confrontation, rioting, the breakdown of civil order in some places, and the destruction of the homes of the communities in which the rioters themselves live, actually is no way forward and offers no hope for anyone.
Bishop McKeown, the church in Northern Ireland, the Catholic Church, and indeed partners that you have from the other churches in Northern Ireland, have really been at the forefront to try and foster dialogue and understanding across the community divide in Northern Ireland. And you'd really come such a very long way, but you said then in your answer that some perceive the peace process as not working. What do you mean by this?
I suppose the genesis of our conflict is surprising in the sense that while the politicians from the largest parties, the elected parties, are now amicably working in government, when they wouldn't even speak to one another, it actually was the churches 20, 30, 40 years ago who held civil society together. So the churches have made an enormous contribution individually and as organisations in giving that conviction that yes, even though it's a distance away, peace and reconciliation can be found. That's all the Christian churches together. There would be those called dissident Republicans who at the present time believe that the participation by Sinn Féin in the Northern Ireland government with the party of Dr. Ian Paisley, the Democratic Unionist Party, that really is a betrayal of all those who fought to, inverted commas, end British rule in Ireland, and that really the only way forward is to destroy anything that seems to make Northern Ireland governable. So they actually hope that through chaos, through in some ways the anarchy that conflict might generate, that they then can say Northern Ireland will fall apart and somehow or other from the ashes a wonderful United Ireland will rise. So there would be that political agenda of those who are opposed to the current Sinn Féin strategy, and there would also be those on the Unionist side who are opposed to the Democratic Unionist Party sharing power with Sinn Féin, whom they would describe as the enemies of the state. So, but the majority, I'm quite convinced, the majority have voted in the election there in the spring for parties that are committed to finding ways forward on a political basis, and the churches are very keen to encourage that process, however imperfect it may be at times.
How much do you think that the current economic crisis and the effects it's having on the ordinary people would have a role to play in this return to violence?
I think certainly we know from most Western European countries that there have been huge cuts in public services and the promise of more coming down the line. And there are always those who are happy to use dissatisfaction, unemployment, lack of hope in many communities to serve their own purposes. Very often you don't ask who's rioting, but who's benefiting from this rioting. And very often it's people who don't even get their hands dirty themselves who actually are quite happy to encourage discontent among young people and then use them in the firing line in order to make their own political points. But yes, the current financial difficulties, the lack of hope for many people, the lack of employment, the lack of prospects and the reduction in services certainly means there is a pool of dissatisfied young people who are only too easily exploited by others who wish to take advantage of them.
That was Bishop Donal McKeown, Auxiliary Bishop of Down and Connor, speaking to my colleague Emma McCarthy. In India, becoming pregnant with a baby girl can have fatal consequences. Such is the traditional preference for a boy that millions of female fetuses are being aborted, and the number is rising each year. Some commentators have called it a silent but massive suppression of human life on a scale that is almost akin to genocide. Girls in India are often viewed as a burden, not least because tradition demands that a girl's family provide a dowry for their daughter's marriage, a practice that continues today even though dowries have been ruled illegal. Another factor that helps explain why so many unborn baby girls are not living to see the light of day is the growing use of sex determination scans for pregnant women. Here again, the practice is illegal, but the law is widely flouted. Often when the parents discover through the scan that their unborn child is a girl rather than the longed-for boy, the decision is taken to abort the fetus. As a result of this growing trend to abort the female child, the ratio of girls to boys is dropping rapidly throughout India. In 1991, there were 945 females to 1,000 males. But 10 years later, that had dropped to just 927 females. And in some states, such as Punjab, the number of females being born compared to males is dramatically lower. The Catholic Church in India has spoken out strongly against the practice of female feticide and has earmarked the 8th of September as Girl Child Day to help persuade parents of the equal worth and dignity of both boys and girls. The Church says girls are not just being selectively killed in the womb in India, but in some extreme cases are left to die after birth. In addition, girls are often neglected or mistreated throughout their childhood and then by their husband's family when they marry. Cardinal Oswald Gracious is the Archbishop of Bombay and the president of the Indian Catholic Bishops' Conference. He calls the selective abortion of baby girls in the womb a diabolical practice.
I think it's because of the whole idea that the girl is a second-class citizen. We are trying to fight against that forcefully. You see, traditionally, a girl in many places was considered a burden, partly sociologically because economically she had later on take dowry, etc. Therefore, families did not consider it a blessing when a daughter was born, but it was a blessing when a son was born. Now, with the possibility of determining the sex of the fetus, people have got into the idea of female feticide. And this, as you can see, is diabolical because it's not only taking life, but also taking life selectively of women.
But how many baby girls are being aborted each year in India? And where is the practice most common? Well, to find out more, I spoke to Sister Lily Francis, who heads the Catholic Bishops' Commission for Women and Children.
Around 500,000 female fetuses are aborted every year.
And where is the practice most prevalent?
It is practiced in Punjab. For every 1,000 boy children, they have only 300 girl children in some part of Punjab. But even Delhi, it is affected. Delhi ratio, as per the census, 808 girls for 1,000 boys. Also, we see the third child in the family, usually the ratio goes much, much low, 312 girls for 1,000 boys.
So in many areas of India, there's now a very distorted ratio and a glut of boys in a way.
Yes, yes.
Maria George Loy is a Catholic sociology student in New Delhi who has done research into the practice of female feticide. She spoke to me about the widespread bias and discrimination against females in Indian society that help explain this growing trend to abort baby girls.
I think the reason why it is increasing is that women are constantly being considered as a liability in India, because of factors such as dowry. And women are considered as a liability because of the dowry amount that has to be paid when they get married. And because they are getting married to a family that is outside, the woman does not prove as an asset to her own family in which she was born.
Experts say that although Indians know that female feticide is being widely practiced, thanks to the growing availability of sex selection scans, people don't like talking about it openly. And in many of these cases, the pregnant woman is being forced against her will to abort her unborn baby girl because of pressure from her husband and his family. There are some cases where the pregnant woman will rebel against this pressure to abort her baby girl. But as Loy explains, when women do this, they run a serious risk of being badly beaten by either her husband or his family.
Women, when they rebel, they are battered, they are pushed and they are kicked so that the child somehow is aborted.
So you're saying that if the woman does not agree, violence is likely to be used against her?
Yeah, if she opposes that, yes, I will have my child against the wishes of the family, she is battered. Many succumb to the pressure, and even if the child is allowed to live, she is not looked after properly by the in-laws, or the woman is not encouraged enough to educate the child, or she's not given the means to educate the child or to look after her properly.
Despite the worrying statistics, Cardinal Gracious says he hopes the trend towards aborting more and more female fetuses will diminish eventually, as people come to realise the implications of this practice.
I think that as people get more educated, as people get more enlightened, as people the world is becoming more and more a little village, people see the role of women in society, I am hopeful that this trend will gradually begin to diminish, and I hope it will die out completely.
There's a saying in Indian society that raising a girl is like watering a plant in your neighbour's garden. With attitudes like this, there's little wonder that so many females in India are being denied the right to be born. But, as Loy reminds us, it's difficult to change deeply rooted attitudes and traditions in a hurry. Happily, as Loy herself made clear, she does not share the bias against female children felt by so many of her compatriots. Let's end with her views.
This attitude does prevail, and I think it has nothing to do with education as such. It is a mindset that has been inculcated in the people, something which is widely said around, that the girl child is a liability to the family.
Are you married?
No, I'm not married.
But when you say were to get married, I assume that you would be fighting very strongly for the right for any girl child that you were carrying to be allowed the right to be born.
Yes, definitely. I would love to have a lot of girl children, and I will definitely fight for her rights.
I was speaking there to Maria Loy from Delhi, and you earlier heard the voices of Cardinal Gracious, Archbishop of Bombay, and Sister Lily Francis. There was no Wednesday general audience for Pope Benedict this week, as he is currently on holiday until the start of August at the summer papal residence of Castel Gandolfo, south of Rome. During these weeks, he is spending time doing some of his favourite activities, such as reading, writing, and of course, praying. Christian prayer was the focus of Pope Benedict's latest series of catechesis at the general audience. And so I thought it was fitting to end this programme with a prayer for the Pope. Lord, there is one intention which I know can never be out of place before thy throne, the intention which regards the spiritual and temporal welfare of thy vicar on earth. I pray that this present pontiff may receive the light of thy Holy Spirit in the decisions which he has to make. I pray that his voice be listened to by Catholics and non-Catholics alike. I pray that he may have the courage to resist evil as thou didst thyself resist it, and that he may never allow disappointment to wither his designs for the furtherance of thine interests. Amen. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow, and you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.